following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And it's a new week, such as it is. Welcome to a Monday, everyone. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. And now it's in the rearview mirror, and we look forward to the next one. Just know we've got holidays on the way, so maybe there's more time off in your future. Certainly, there's more time off for Congress. Yeah, we need to talk about recess time. But let's start with they're back today. So Congress was out last week. This whole thing, it's you need a scorecard, but I'll do my best to keep you abreast of what's going on. So not this past Friday, but the Friday before, Congress passed the BIF, which is a stupid name. But now they're calling it the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Yeah, baby. And Joe Biden signed it into law today. I watched most of it. Didn't watch the whole thing. I watched most of it. And I didn't even flag it where Biden came. Maybe I did. Is this where he comes in? No, that's Kamala Harris. All right. So, you know what? You heard it. You don't need me to play it. There was nothing news breaking, nothing earth shattering. Kyrsten Sinema got up and spoke. There was a smattering of, you know, polite applause, I suppose. It was what it was. There was one part of it, though, and I wish I did cue it up, because they were talking about, we made these great strides in infrastructure and we're going to do, I said, and because I wanted to interject. No, we did part of it. The other part is still to come. And along those lines, here's some, I guess, breaking news for you. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said that they will have their score for the Build Back Better bill, the reconciliation part of the package, on Friday. On Friday, just in time for Congress to go on recess again. Because the following week is Thanksgiving, so they have to be out for Thanksgiving, don't you know? And here's the problem. So they're out for Thanksgiving. Let me pull up my calendar here. So Thanksgiving this week, or this year, is on November 25th. Good enough. So next week, we have Monday is the 22nd. So Congress is off all next week, right? But when they get back, they only have up until that Friday. They get back Monday the 29th. On Friday, December 3rd, guess what happens? Well, that's when we run out of money again. And not only that, depending on what estimates you're looking at, we hit the debt ceiling again. When are they planning to do this? They really needed to take last week off? I know it's too late to take it back, but come on.
Come on, man.
This is ridiculous already. Oh, funny. The Florida Democrats are sending out emails. Let me just read to you the headline. Here's the headline of an email sent by the DCCC, but from, you know, in Florida. President Biden signs historic infrastructure deal that Carlos Jimenez and Maria Elvira Salazar voted against into law. Yeah, we get it. The Republicans voted against it. You know, actually, I was surprised to see a number of Republicans actually show up at the signing ceremony today at the White House. So Joe Biden, you know, the bill was passed and on his desk a week ago, Friday. But he held off for a week in signing it because he wanted today's photo op. And I guess they needed that kumbaya moment to show, see, we can do things bipartisanly. Oh, please. Yeah. So, that happened. So now, you know, they're still talking about some of them. I think Chuck Schumer mentioned it in his speech. Kyrsten Sinema shockingly did not. The fact that they hope later this week to pass the Build Back Better legislation. Well, maybe, just maybe, they'll get the CBO score on Friday and they'll read it on Friday and do whatever they need to do and come back on Saturday to vote for the thing. Because, you know, Thanksgiving is not till Thursday. They really don't have to leave on Friday night. Can someone do their job, please? It's not like we don't have anything important going on, because there's also December 3rd looming. Yeah. So just a lot of things to keep in mind. Now, concurrently, while this stuff is going on in Congress, there are, well, there's three, not necessarily trials, but there's three court proceedings going on with in very controversial and, yes, racially charged courtrooms, I'll say. And then there's a fourth thing, the fourth thing being January 6th. Well, Steve Bannon, so Friday, we get off the air Friday. I'm scrambling to do Brad's show, but Steve Bannon was indicted like right before I hit the air on Friday, right? Or right after I hit the air, after I got off the air. Somewhere in there, Steve Bannon was indicted. He wasn't made to report on Friday, but today he surrendered. So if you're thinking like I am that, well, okay, Steve Bannon surrenders. He's indicted on two charges. One for failing to appear for that October 14th deposition before the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And the second one for refusing to provide the documents the panel had asked for. So if he's convicted, Steve Bannon faces a minimum of 30 days and a maximum of 1 year in prison, as well as a fine of $100 to $1,000. After all, this is only a misdemeanor. But, you know, let me float this because I don't know the answer. And if there are any attorneys out there who do know the answer, feel free to call in and educate me. 954-889-6410 is the number. If you ignore a proceeding from a criminal court, from a trial court, if you fail to show up for a subpoena, you refuse to comply, do they arrest you? I mean, what happens? The reason I'm asking this, and no, I don't know the answer, is because there needs to be some kind of parity there. A parity, not parody. Two counts. I said two counts. If you don't show up, if you refuse to comply with a subpoena from a court of law, what happens? That's what I want to know, because what we have here is a problem of oversight in our government. Every school child learns about our system of checks and balances, where you've got three branches of government and they each have oversight responsibility of the other branches. Well, if they can't enforce congressional subpoenas with any teeth, then there is no oversight by Congress of the executive branch. And we need to rethink some things, because we need oversight of the executive branch, because when you don't have oversight, we get what we had with the former guy in there. And we certainly don't need that again. Right? So I'm going to find out the answer to that. Again, if anybody knows, there has to be the same kind of penalty for refusing to comply with a congressional subpoena as there is for refusing to supply with a subpoena from a criminal court or another court of law. And if there isn't, then we may as well stop, because then Congress has no oversight of the executive branch. It's just one of the many ways in which our government, our country, is broken. And boy, is it broken. And today we're going to talk about healing ourselves. You may recall it was a couple of weeks ago, I was supposed to have a guest on. It was the author of this book, The Plant Hunter. And it's a doctor who, partially for personal reasons, but other reasons as well, is that she is an ethnobotanist, I think. She looks for plants that heal. And I sort of, in the weird mindset I'm in, thought, we're going to be on our own in a while, because if shit keeps going in the direction it's going, all bets are off. Our insurance, our healthcare industry is a health insurance industry, so we're screwed from the get-go. I think more and more people are going to go off the grid. I worry that we're going to descend into some kind of a domestic, trying not to say the word civil war, but you know where I'm going with this. And we're going to, I think, we're going to take a few giant steps backwards in terms of, you know, living off the grid, taking care of ourselves. It would be good to know what plants can help us and, you know, thereby avoiding the pharmaceutical companies. Anyway, that's my segue into the guest who should be here today. We traded emails personally. Anyway, she was not informed. It was a breakdown in communications when she wasn't here last time. So anyway, so that's going on. So let me tell you what happened today. Lots of breaking news today. We told you about the bipartisan infrastructure bill signed today at the White House. Patrick Leahy is retiring. Whoa, go figure. An 81-year-old senator says, yeah, I'm good. I've been here for 40 years. Leahy, he announced today that he would not run for a ninth term. Remember, each Senate term is 6 years. Yeah, that's a lot of years. But he said, it's time to put down the gavel. It's time to pass. Or I could do it in my Patrick Leahy voice. It's time to pass the torch to the next Vermonter who will carry on this great work for our great state. It is time to come home. It is. Now, please, Chuck Grassley, Dianne Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn. Oh, there are a bunch of others I could reel off. Join them, please. Retire. Enjoy what's left of your life. Enjoy the grandchildren. Anyway, so Leahy is out. He is the senior senator, yes, from Vermont. Bernie Sanders is the junior senator from Vermont, in case you were wondering. Stephen Bannon did turn himself in, right? He showed up, but they didn't, they held off arraignment. I don't know if he said he waived arraignment or whatever. The thing is, so he showed up in federal court. They did not throw him in jail. He's coming back on Thursday or Friday of this week, where they're going to do the next thing. But they did not even, you know, throw him in jail for this. Then why bother? Really, just why bother with any of it? Beto O'Rourke launched his campaign for governor of Texas. So that's going on. Oh, this is good. Alex Jones. You know him, the guy from InfoWars. He's a InfoWars host and a conspiracy theorist. And thankfully, he was found liable today for damages and lawsuits brought by the parents of children killed at Sandy Hook. Because, of course, Alex Jones claimed that the massacre was a hoax. Judge Barbara Bellis took the rare step of defaulting Jones in the defamation lawsuits for his and his company's failure to produce critical material information that the plaintiffs needed to prove their claims. The default means the judge found in favor of the parents and will hold a hearing on how much damages he should pay. Boom. Done. That's how all this should go. So today, now we get to it. So there are three. I mentioned there are like three cases going on. One is a civil case or a group of civil cases in Charlottesville, Virginia, against the organizers of the, what did they call it? The Protect the Right nonsense, whatever, whoever those white supremacists and Nazis were who marched in Charlottesville in 2017 with their tiki torches, chanting lovely sayings like Jews will not replace us. Yeah. You know, that same event where those people killed Heather Heyer, a woman who was there peacefully protesting. Yeah. A counter protester. So, so there's a lawsuit going on, and frankly, there has not been much coverage of it. I'm going to look around and this week try to find more about it, about this suit. But it's a number of lawsuits joined together, all being heard at the same time. Again, there must not be cameras in the courtroom because, again, I'm not hearing much coverage of it, but I will continue to look. Two other cases going on. One is, there's two that I got to talk about here. So let's start in Georgia, where three men, I'm biting my tongue because I was going to use a different word for them, but three sorry excuses for human beings are on trial for murdering Ahmaud Arbery. So But God, this is just astounding. I'm gonna share some video with you. So first, this was last week. This must have been I don't know what day it was, Thursday or Friday or something, right? This defense attorney, and I have his name written down somewhere, but I can't recall it. Anyway, his name doesn't matter. He's a piece of shit. That's who he is. So one of the defense attorneys gets up. They notice that Al Sharpton was in the courthouse with Ahmed Armory's parents. And so, this is what happened. This is what this defense attorney said.
Over 100. The idea that we're going to be serially bringing these people in to sit with the victim's family one after another, obviously, there's only so many pastors they can have.
Only so many pastors they can have.
Right now, that's fine, but then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here.
We don't want any more black pastors coming in here.
Jesse Jackson, whoever was in here earlier this week,
Jesse Jackson, he said.
Sitting with the victim's family, trying to influence a jury in this case. And I'm not saying the state is even aware that Mr. Sharpton was in the courtroom. I certainly wasn't aware of it till last night.
Uh-huh.
But I think the court can understand my concern.
No, not at all.
About bringing people in who really don't have any ties to this case other than political interests.
Oh, other than political interests. Now, this video got cut off, but oh my goodness. Let me play. This was at the end of that clip that I heard in another venue, but I just had to share. This is the end of that clip that got cut off of that video.
The idea that we're going to be serially bringing these people in to sit with the victim's family one after another, obviously, there's only so many pastors they can have. And if their pastor's Al Sharpton right now, that's fine. But then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here.
Yeah, okay.
Or other Jesse Jackson, whoever was in here earlier this week, sitting with the victim's family, trying to influence a jury in this case. And I'm not saying the state is even aware that Mr. Sharpton was in the courtroom. I certainly wasn't aware of it.
Oh, shoot. Okay, that was the wrong clip. Oh, this is the right clip. Okay, his name is Kevin Gao, by the way. Well, you just heard it twice because, you know, maybe how the reprehensibleness of it didn't sink in the first time. Here's the end of that clip.
If a bunch of folks came in here dressed like Colonel Sanders with white masks sitting in the back, I mean, that would be good.
If a bunch of folks came in here dressed like Colonel Sanders sitting in the back with white masks, that would be, I don't know what he said, but the judge cut him off. Now, you'll also recall, this is the case in which one black juror was seated. 11 white jurors in the Atlanta area. And the judge even called it out when they came back in, saying, I can't say this wasn't racially motivated. There's nothing I can do about it. But he did call it out and say this was, to paraphrase, fucked up. Okay, so now let's go to today. So, but there was an apology in there somewhere. Let me read it to you. This is the defense attorney, whatever his name was, said, Kevin Gao is his name. He represents William Roddy Bryan, one of the three defendants accused of killing Ahmed Arbery. And here's the quote, what he told the judge before testimony began today. My apologies to anyone who might have inadvertently been offended. I will let the court know that if my statements yesterday were overly broad, I will follow up with a more specific motion. Oh, this was Friday. With a more specific motion on Monday, putting those concerns in the proper context. Gao said that he'd been, quote, asked to address some comments, but did not elaborate on who had told him. The judge clarified that the court had not asked him to apologize. So you heard what he said. We don't need any more black, we don't want any more black judges here. And then he said, made the statement about, one I just played for you. Now it gets better. So today, guess who showed up? Despite Gao's statement saying that Jesse Jackson had been in the courtroom, I don't believe he had. But guess what? He was there today. So this is what happened today.
The issue that Ray brought up previously is, how many pastors does the Arbery family have?
Oh, my God.
We had the Reverend Al Sharpton here earlier, last week. And I'm not keeping track, and I think the court has indicated the court doesn't intend to ask anyone
He's not
to keep
keeping track,
track
no.
of who was in the gallery. But I don't know who Mr. Jackson, Reverend Jackson, is pastoring here.
Oh, my goodness.
My understanding is, and I was given names, that the Arbery family have local pastors. They also have attorneys. Mr. Arbery, Marcus, has a team of lawyers to comfort him through these proceedings. Certainly, Ms. Cooper has been amply comforted by her legal counsel. And we are concerned about whether it's conscious or unconscious, the impact of their presence with respect to the jury and with respect to the proceedings in this case. And I guess the next question is, which pastor is next? Is Raphael Warnock going to make it be the next person appearing this afternoon? We don't know. Your Honor, I would submit, with all respect to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, that this is no different than bringing in police officers or uniformed prison guards in a small town where
you
a young
think?
Black man has been accused
it's a little different.
Of assaulting a law enforcement officer
God.
Or corrections officer.
Oh, my God.
And as I have noted before, the city of Brunswick is indeed a fishbowl.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I understand that the court, maybe I misunderstood the court the other day, but I think the court had indicated it was the court's understanding or assumption that the Arbery family is giving up seats in the public gallery so that these gentlemen may be present.
Yeah.
With all due respect, Your Honor, the seats in the public gallery of a courtroom are not like courtside seats at a Lakers game. There are no First Amendment rights. In the public gallery of a courtroom, there is no standing of any particular individual
God.
To be present in the public gallery of a courtroom.
Oh, my God.
And there is no reason for these prominent icons in the civil rights movement to be here.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a case that has been postured in...
Oh, my... And that's where it cuts off. Holy shit. And Jesse Jackson's just sitting there, not bothering anyone, sitting there. I'm sure giving comfort to the family. Wow. Racism! Hello! Civil rights attorney Ben Crump tweeted that he would bring, quote, 100 black pastors to pray with the Arbery family outside court next week. This is just astounding. Astounding. By the way, this attorney, his client, Brian, is accused of joining the, he's the guy who was following in his truck who chased down the 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery after seeing him running through their shores. He was jogging. And they killed him. Brian is actually the one who shot the video of the younger McMichael shooting Arbery three times at close range with a shotgun in the middle of the street. So that's going on in Atlanta right now. Did you notice how he invoked Raphael Warnock's name too? Yeah, it was just lovely. Just lovely. But today, of course, again, all eyes were on the courthouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where... Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial for murder. And I must say, I watched some of some of the prosecution's closing statement today. I didn't watch any of the defense stuff. I've heard enough from those people. But you know, as much as I criticized that prosecutor last week, because he was kind of doing a shitty job, he did a decent job today in the close. Now, I don't have any video to play from that. I do, well, you know what? I'm not even going to get into that. There was a thing on Friday where the defense attorney was bitching because the prosecutor wanted to show some photos, right, that were taken that night, and he wanted to blow them up. And so he did what we all do when you have a photo on a computer and you want to enlarge it, you use your fingers and you, right? And you go like this. I mean, I'm not enlarging any picture there. But the judge is a moron and the defense attorney is just making shit up as he goes along. And they're going, well, you're editing the photos. He's not altering anything. But the judge ruled, I think today he walked it back because he had to. But they went around and around for like a half hour on if you enlarge a photo, you blow it up by using two fingers and elongating it, are you altering the pixels or some bullshit nonsense like that? But the bottom line is, this judge, this defense attorney, is claiming that Kyle Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense, and therefore he is not guilty because he was merely protecting himself. Now, remember, this kid had a friend buy him an AR-15. He was 17 years old. He was not legally able to have this gun. The judge threw out the gun charge for another bullshit reason today that I'm not even going to get into. But they're doing opening, they're doing closing arguments today, and then the jury gets the case. So it should be tonight. I just want to read you a very quick op-ed from the Washington Post, from Alexandra Petrie. This came over just an hour ago. And the headline, it'll make sense, when I get through it. Headline reads, opinion, teen who showed up in operating room with scalpel had idolized doctors all his life. Okay, just bear with me. Just listen to this brilliance. Alexandra Petrie writes, the important thing to remember about the decisions that left two people dead and a lot of other people holding loose kidneys with expressions of abject horror is that the teenager who showed up in the operating room with the scalpel he had brought from home was a big fan of the doctors and thought he would be able to help. What ensued was very sad. Obviously, it was sad. If this teen had not been there, it does seem that, at minimum, he would not personally have stabbed anyone. It is possible that some people who are not now alive would still be alive, but it is also possible that they would have perished in unrelated accidents. We can never truly know, so the important thing to keep in mind is what he meant to do. Maybe not that. Wouldn't we all have done the same in his position with our father on the operating table? Well, not literally his father. In fact, not someone he knew personally at all. But if there were not some kind of relationship there, just sort of showing up with a weapon and thinking you would be able to help would be even more bizarre and terrifying, which this, of course, was not. Because again, he was a big fan of the doctors and always dreamed of being one someday. This makes his presence understandable, and we can't possibly pass judgment on him for what happened. Multiple stabbings. When he was younger, he watched Doc McStuffins all the time and has described it as formative to anyone who'll listen. He played Operation frequently as a boy, and the nose would light up almost never. That two people are now dead as a result of his actions is tragic. But the real tragedy would be if people were discouraged from showing up to operating theaters with scalpels and full hearts and a can-do attitude and zero medical degrees. He was merely trying to be a doctor, which is something you can do simply by showing up with equipment you brought from home. And sometimes doctors kill people too, so in that sense, he was already living his dream. No, this is not an unprecedented change in how we describe people who have killed other people, a benefit of the doubt we're going to be extending to everyone from now on. This is just a one-time special, because this young man with a scalpel was white. Yes, this boy just wanted people to be safer. And although the consequence of his actions was the exact opposite of that, consequences are not what count, at least not in this case. We won't even say that it was regrettable he was there and that we wish he hadn't been. We're instead going to praise him for what he thought he was doing. A teenager showed up with weapons and made a situation worse. But the important thing is that he says he meant well. That's what matters. He thought he was helping. If this kid walks, I was going to say I'll lose all faith in our justice system such as it is, but that would imply that I had faith in it to begin with, right? If I sound a bit cynical, because I am. If I sound a bit dejected, it's because I am. Something's got to give, something's got to change, because the way we're going is not, is not what we need right now. In fact, I could say we need the exact opposite. So anyway, with that, let me do one more thing. Our guest is here and I'm very excited to see her. Cassandra Leah Quave. Hold on 1 second. And I'm probably, mispronouncing her name. Cassandra, hi, welcome to the show. Is it Quave? Is it Quave? How do I say your name?
It's Quave.
It's Quave. And you go by Cassie?
Yeah.
Okay. So, hi, Cassie. Thank you so much for joining us. We had our wires crossed a couple of weeks ago, but I'm glad we were able to get it back together. Because I got to tell you, I've had this book sitting here in my studio since we were supposed to talk. And every time, we have twins. Every time my daughter comes over, she's like, can I take it now? Because my daughter just really wants to read this. So I told her, let me do the interview and then you can have the book. So,
fabulous.
So let's start with how you got to this place where you're the plant hunter, where, and yeah, I love your Twitter handle is, you say it.
Yeah, it's Quave Ethnobot. Maybe not the best conceived Twitter handle. It's a bit difficult to spell.
Quave Ethnobot. So what is an ethnobot?
Yeah, so ethnobotany is the study of how people use plants for everything from medicine to food to construction and more.
Okay. And you,
I'm hearing a little bit of feedback.
Are you?
I don't know if you're hearing it.
Yeah, I'm not. And it sounds okay. Here. I've been having a weird thing going on. Hopefully it should go away in a couple of minutes. If it doesn't, we'll try to regroup, but hopefully you can get through it. So you were born with a birth defect. You had a problem with one of your legs. Is that what got you started on this road to alternative medicines?
You know, I was born with multiple congenital deformities. So I had problems with my leg, but I also had problems that later developed with my hip and my spine. And, you know, today is one of those days where I've had to slow down because I like hurt my back over the weekend. I'm like getting old. But it's also the problems with, you know, with my skeletal system. So I'm no stranger to pain. And I think as many people that deal with chronic pain know, you will try anything and everything to try and help sort those problems out. And so I had a young introduction to medicine because of all of those problems that I was born with and my, you know, time I spent in and out of the hospital. I had 1 to 2 surgeries a year throughout my entire childhood. So I am literally the million-dollar woman when it comes to reconstructive kind of skeletal surgeries. So it was those experiences that got me really interested in medicine, but it also really showed me the strengths and shortcomings of medicine. And so when I was in college, you know, I'd long been interested in nature, but also in kind of systems of medicine and how does the practice of medicine differ from culture to culture? And I kind of stumbled into the field of ethnobotany, you know, it was the end of my junior year taking a class on tropical ecology, where I read a book that was called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice by Mark Plotkin. And he described this period of working with a local healer and really diving into this whole other system of medicine. And after reading that, I just knew I had to go to the Amazon myself and experience this other system of medicine and learn from a healer. And that's what I did. And it really, you know, took me down a path that's very different from where I thought I would go earlier in life.
Now, you are a medical doctor. So this runs concurrent.
So I'm a PhD, not a medical doctor.
Oh, you're a PhD. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I'm in a clinical department. So all of my colleagues are medical doctors.
Okay. All right. Yes. So, but now when you were younger, your family moved to Florida. I'm in Southeast Florida. You lived down here and you started exploring, I guess, childhood curiosity. You did science experiments, the science fair, and you learned what was in, you know, puddle water and stuff. And this cultivated your curiosity in this field?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Florida is such an amazing place to grow up because it's warm all year long, you know, more or less. You know, in the winter it can get to the very chilly 50s.
It can.
But, you know, I spent a lot of my time as a kid on crutches because of all of my surgeries. But because of those crutches, I had really, really amazing upper body strength. So I could climb trees like nobody's business. And I would spend a lot of time in trees looking at the creatures crawling around. I'd spend time up there reading books and just observing nature. You know, I grew up in a time when it was completely normal for your parents to kind of lock the kids out of the house for the whole day, like come back for food and we'll see you at dark.
Right,
you know, and
right. So you come home in dark. Right.
Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, how I grew up. And it was an amazing opportunity to get to experience nature in those ways. And as you mentioned, I got really into science fair. I know many parents today probably think of science fair with trepidation because it's usually, you know, this huge stressful event because the kid brings the assignment home, you know, and the science fair is just a few days away.
Of course. Right.
But for me, it was like opening up a whole, like almost, I would say like a sport, you know, because I couldn't really compete in athletics as a kid. You know, Paralympic activities weren't very big. And I was from a really small town, so there weren't many kids like me. And so for me, science fair really became my sport. It was this way I was able to design questions and investigate the things that made me curious. And whether it was looking into pond water or examining what's, you know, swimming around in my dog's spit to looking at E. coli and ground beef. I mean, I just kept going and going. And in a way, I never really stopped, because that's what I do today, is I get to ask interesting questions. The difference is, of course, now I have a large laboratory and a whole team of researchers that help me investigate those questions.
Gotcha. So the reason I'm so intrigued by your book and by the work you do, Cassie, is because I think the pharmaceutical industry in this country is criminal. I think, you know, I just read somewhere about some drug. I don't even know what it is, but it costs them. I think it costs, their cost is $7 a dose. And they sell it for $700 a dose. That, to me, is criminal. And if it isn't, it should be. I know insulin is not an expensive drug to produce, right? But people are choosing between insulin and food. We shouldn't be in this position. And the Congress makes it worse by saying, well, Medicare can't negotiate with the big pharmaceutical companies to bring the prices down. Why? Because Big Pharma gives these Congress people all kinds of donations. There's no reason for it at all. And so, you know, I'm thinking there's got to be another way. A lot of our medicines, you know, the ancient Chinese did it for millions of years. I don't, my numbers are wrong, but you know, there, herbal medicines have been around forever. We're now seeing the amazing benefits of cannabis, even though some knew some benefits for decades now. So I'm guessing there have to be solutions out there in nature that in some instances we can bypass the criminal pharmaceutical companies.
Well, you know, the great irony, I think, is that many of the modern pharmaceuticals that we enjoy today originally came from nature.
Right.
And I think we've lost sight of that. You know, a lot of our groundbreaking drugs for everything from cancer to pain to malaria to heart disease, a lot of the chemical scaffolds, this kind of blueprints to the makeup of what goes into the drugs, a lot of those were actually discovered in plants, going back to traditional medicines, because people were using these plants already for similar indications. The economics of pharmaceutical development is incredibly complex, in some ways corrupt. I think that more needs to be done. And the economics have also jeopardized our current state of antibiotics. Mm. You know, pharma has largely exited the antibiotics game, because you can't recoup the kind of return on investment that they're looking for, like you can with someone that has, for example, a need for insulin on a daily basis, right? Because if you have an infection, the hope is that you can treat this in, you know, 7 to 10 days,
right. and then
you don't need the medication any longer. So it's, there are a lot of, you know, complicated factors at play. I'm by no means an economist, but I do think that we have to address this problem, because antibiotics are really not only the game changer for modern medicine, the entire tower of medicine falls down if we lose antibiotics, which is the path that we're on. I mean, we currently have around 700,000 people globally that die due to untreatable antimicrobial resistant infections. And that number is projected to reach 10 million a year by the year 2050. If you think about everything from, you know, minor surgeries to more major surgeries like hip replacements or childbirth or even
anything,
like a UTI, right, or strep throat. Imagine a time when those just can't go away with that magic pill, right? So we need to fill the pipeline. And that's where a lot of my research is driven, is trying to find new solutions to dealing with infection. Maybe not always necessarily killing the bacteria outright, but working through other pathways that have been used by healers for centuries, such as reducing the capacity of some of these microbes to cause harm, or by strengthening the body. And so I just think there's tremendous potential in plants. I think they've already given us a rich, you know, number of drugs that we currently benefit from. And I think it's normal for people to be really curious about herbs. I mean, we all want to take control of our health. And I think COVID-19 really taught us that, is like, there's a great desire to, you know, take control of your health. And one way I always tell everyone is think about how you can eat your medicine, whether it's through herbal teas or through, you know, a plant forward diet. There are a lot of ways that you can, you know, maintain robust health in that way.
I want to get back to the antibiotic thing for just a moment, because this is, it's like a double-edged sword. On one hand, you're saying the drug companies don't want to waste time in developing more because it's not profitable enough for them. On the other hand, they've been so overprescribed that the germs, the bacteria, is morphing to, so that the antibiotics we have are no longer effective. Right. So there's a problem on both ends. So we're losing out both ways. Have you found, I mean, is there, can you come up with an antibiotic from out in the wild that will cure your infection?
Yeah. Well, and there's one other thing before I jump into some of our discoveries. You know, it's not just overprescription. It's, we have massive use of antibiotics in agriculture, in terms of, like, you know, giving antibiotics to animals, to livestock that are being raised in very concentrated, kind of unnaturally concentrated feedlots. Mm-hmm. But we're also using these antimicrobial agents on everything from flower cultivations. If you think about tulips and roses are being sprayed with the antifungals. You also have even orange trees, citrus in Florida, which we've had the devastation, of course, of greening or greening disease. You know, there have been campaigns to spray groves with massive amounts of a form of tetracycline. And that's not okay.
Right.
That's not okay to put that much antibiotic into the environment.
And it's in the food chain, right?
It's more than just overprescribing. It's the reckless use of antibiotics. And we have to do a better job with stewardship across the board.
Wow.
Now, going back to your question about what have we come up with so far?
Yeah.
In the book, I describe some of our search for different ways of, again, addressing infections. And again, I'll go back to another example from Florida. I'll tell you about one of our discoveries from the Brazilian pepper tree.
Okay.
Now, any good Floridian knows that this is a hated plant. It's a noxious weed. It grows up everywhere. It smells like strong pepper. It can be kind of irritating to the eyes when you crush up the leaves. But if you go back in time, and I'm talking centuries, we found records that this plant was really important in Brazil as a form of traditional medicine for treating ulcers and wounds. And I get excited about anything where there's like pustulant oozing wounds and there's a plant stuck on that. Yes, because that's a clue. It's a clue, right? That plant might have something that's useful in treating infection. And when we looked at the fruits of that plant, we found that they don't kill or slow down the growth of bacteria, but what they do is they block their ability to communicate with one another and basically take away their ability to cause harm to tissues.
Wow.
So if you think about, you know, the toxins that bacteria produce that cause all that tissue damage, and the presence of compounds that we've isolated from the fruits of the Brazilian pepper tree, it shuts that system down. So that's just one example of one I'm really excited about, and I think could have huge potential in the future, either as a standalone drug or maybe in combination therapies with antibiotics. Another really cool plant we've been doing some work on is the American beautyberry. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's kind of used in landscaping in the Southeast U.S. It grows in the wild. Indigenous people of the Southeast used it as a source of food, but also as an insect repellent and for skin disease. Again, there's the clue, skin disease.
Right.
Right. So we discovered a compound in the leaves of that plant that basically restore the activity of beta-lactam antibiotics in treating MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So another idea is, can we take some of these antibiotics that no longer work and are on the shelf? Can we take them back off the shelf, make them work again by combining them with some of these interesting plant compounds? So these are just two examples. I mean, and they're here in Florida, so of plants that we've studied.
Are you in Florida now?
No, I'm in Georgia.
Oh, okay.
But I always think of Florida as my home.
I hear you. I hear you. Yeah. Things are crazy here now. You're better off not being here. Although Georgia's not a whole lot better. I don't know anymore. We're speaking with Cassandra Leah Quave. The book is The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicine. So, you know, I joked earlier, I said, you know, many of us have known the benefits of cannabis for a long time, Although we didn't know the extent. I mean, the CBD and CBG and CBNs and, you know, the different extracts from this one plant. I mean, I knew as a kid, I can smoke a couple, take a couple of hits and be nicely buzzed. Didn't realize it had all these healing properties. And then, you know, I learned about a friend of mine served time, believe it or not, in federal prison for drug smuggling. The longest sentence of anybody served. He served, like, I don't want to get it wrong, but I want to say he served at least 40 years for bringing pot into the country back in the 70s. And now, and then once he got out, he embarked on this tour called the Silver Tour, educating senior citizens to the benefits of medical marijuana. And through him, I was introduced to Rick Simpson, who does an extraction process and gets oil out of it and uses it really to treat skin cancers. And so I've seen, you know, and I'm guessing if cannabis has this many different uses, there have to be a million other plants out there that have similar properties.
Yeah, I mean, cannabis is a great example. I mean, when it comes to there are ongoing studies looking at the relevance of cannabis for pain. I'm not familiar with any data on cancer, but I used to joke that, you know, cannabis is great for making you feel good, but it's not going to cure your infection. One of my colleagues in Canada, Eric Brown's group, actually found a compound that does have antibacterial activity in cannabis. So, I mean, I think we're still, it's a plant that's becoming more and more subject to study. I think we're going to continue to find new and interesting activities in it. And I mean, it is, like you said, a testament to the amazing healing power of nature. If you think about the ways that plants communicate, the ways that they create this intentional evolutionary, almost like, you know, chemical perfume to communicate with other organisms in their environment. It's just incredible. You can have hundreds of distinct molecules in a single leaf. I mean, and who knows, like, and many times these compounds work in combination in some way, right? So it's not just this idea that we have in modern medicine of single compound against a single pathway. Instead, nature works often by having maybe five compounds hitting on different aspects of the pathway, or some of these are backup compounds. A great example of this is, you know, the study of wormwood for treating malaria. Wormwood yielded a compound known as artemisinin, and this really helped people across the globe that were suffering from malaria, but now we have artemisinin resistance. Well, guess what still works is when you use the whole plant, because within the plant, there are other compounds that are slightly different from the main drug that we used in development that can still get at those targets. And so I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for what's known as polypharmacology, or the study of, you know, really using multiple chemistries to hit at your problem. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from both the plants and the systems of traditional medicine that have relied on these.
So let me ask you this. So when COVID hit and we're all, you know, dealing with this novel coronavirus, something brand new, we've never seen it before, so therefore, you know, the scientists are learning about it as they try to find a cure, try to find a vaccine, try to find whatever. When something like that happens, which obviously, I guess on this level certainly doesn't happen very often, does it excite you in a way? Does it make you go, oh, I got to find something to fix this?
I don't know if excitement's the right word. I was desperate to help, though. I think desperation, that's not as happy of a term,
right,
but
gotcha.
I wanted to leap into the fray. And the end of the book actually ends with the beginning of the pandemic. I've lost a number of friends to this pandemic. It's been a horrific journey. I mean, so many of us have, more than 5 million people have died. So this is not an uncommon experience, I think, for many of us. And from my contacts and different systems of traditional medicine, I knew that healers were using different plants mainly for symptom management because it was new to them as well. But I was really persistent. And I think I wrote like 5 grants in the span of a couple of months, and I got one grant funded. And this is important because, you know, funding is really, it takes a lot of money to do these studies. Mm-hmm. It took us almost $300,000 to run this 1-year study, but we succeeded in completing probably the largest ever screen or study of botanicals for blocking the way that the virus gets into human cells. And my graduate student is wrapping up the final details on this paper. We looked at, I think it was around 1,900 extracts plus a number of isolated compounds from different plants, and found two plants so far that seemed to work pretty well against the variants in a test tube. But they also worked in our kind of pseudotype model, which is where you take a piece of the virus, but also we've got new data showing it works in the live virus, again, in a test tube, not in an animal yet.
Right.
I'm excited about this. I'm cautiously optimistic. I think, you know, one of the concerns with publishing this kind of data is I don't want people to go out and start digging up these plants and using them, or, you know, wiping out populations, because there's so much we still have to do. But that's part of the excitement, is when you put in the blood, sweat, and tears, working at all hours of the day and night, like my team had to do to make this happen. And when you're successful, that's just an incredible feeling.
I'll bet. You know?
And success comes in steps. It's not like, voila, we have an FDA approved drug yet. You know,
right.
it takes time.
Sure. Yeah. So when you're coming at this as a scientist, this is what you do. When you saw some of the stuff that I refer to it all as opposite world, where up is down and in is out, nothing makes sense. You have people denying the science, won't get the vaccine, but first they embraced hydroxychloroquine and now it's ivermectin. And what do you feel when you hear that kind of stuff?
You know, I mean, I have friends from back home that were doing that too. I think it's another testament to the very natural desire to take control of your health. So one of the things I became alarmed at, not only with the misuse of these drugs, why anyone thought an antiparasitic drug would work against a virus. I don't know how that whole trend started,
right.
But I was also concerned around the uses of plants. Plants are actually quite dangerous. Plants like oleander and cinchona bark, to try and treat the disease. Cinchona has, you know, potential for some pretty serious cardiac side effects, and oleander will straight up also because of cardiotoxicity. And so, you know, one thing that I did early on is I engaged in public discourse. I wrote, co-authored an op-ed on the cinchona issue, and I wrote an op-ed on the oleander issue, because my fear was that people would go out and start trying to eat these plants.
Right.
And kill themselves, you know, in a well-intentioned gesture to try and treat themselves, but not having the right knowledge or background of how to do that. And so I feel like scientists have a responsibility. It's not easy to speak out like that. I got a lot of weird hate mail from people that are kind of like, how dare you say I can't eat a poisonous plant? I'm like, well, you know, I mean, there is a distinction, you know, not everything in nature is safe. There are some poisonous plants that are also medicines, but you have to really understand the dosing.
Of course.
And you have to understand how much you can have and how frequently you can have it. And so there's a lot of nuance there. And I think a lot of that nuance is lost in translation when these kind of trends occur.
I'm sure. Well, yeah. All right. I got one more question for you. Obviously you know, when you have pain, whether it's, you know, from your legs or your the problems you've had, or a headache, what do you take?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I'll tell you today, because like I pulled this muscle in my back. It's been killing me. So I used a lot of topical menthol.
Uh-huh.
So people think, well, I know it's in like your cigarettes, right? But menthol is actually really good at helping to deal with topical applications for pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from mint plants. So it's really like a gift from things like peppermint. So I use menthol on that. I'm a big believer in food as medicine. So, you know, when I'm feeling kind of just achy or feeling, you know, not great, I'll make kind of an anti-inflammatory drink or a soup, you know, whether it's a big bowl of, you know, kimchi and soy kind of Korean soup with lots of chilies, or French onion soup, or all the things that make your breath smell amazing, basically. But those are really good for your body, you know, and cooking with turmeric and fresh ground black pepper is a great anti-inflammatory. I grow some different herbs, some medicinal mints in my garden that I'll make a tea of. So there are so many things that are very accessible to everybody. I'm actually really bad at gardening, but these mints survive my brown thumb. And so if I can do it, anybody can, for sure.
Awesome. Well, the book is called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. I'm so glad you're doing this work. Are there many people like you doing this kind of work?
You know, there's not enough. I think we're kind of few, but I'm hoping, you know, one of the big hopes of writing this book is to inspire the next generation of scientists and even some that are already established to take a closer look at nature. There's a lot out there to explore.
Absolutely. I think in many forms and many fronts, we're going to be looking to nature a lot. I just think with things getting so out of control, I think we may be forced into stepping back off the grid a little bit. So it wouldn't hurt to learn what's out there so we can make our own way just in case we eventually have to. Even if we don't have to, knowledge is power, and it's good to be able to know what you're putting in your body. Cassie, Cassandra, Leah, Quave, thank you so much. It was great to meet you and talk to you, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much, Nicole. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You take care. All right. So I'm glad we finally got that together. We weren't able to do it a couple of weeks ago when she was first going to be on the show, but we got it. Is it on Audible? Probably. You know, it's a Viking book. It's a major publisher. So, Joy, it is probably on Audible. Is it on Audible, Cassie? Can you still hear me? Yes. She's saying yes, it's on Audible. So there you go. All right. So, hey, in the couple of minutes we have before our time is up, and it's literally just a couple of minutes, I got to tell you something. Along with my painting stuff, by the way, I don't know if you can see behind me, I have it in a bad position, but I finished. I'm never quite done, but I think I'm finished. I got this giant commission. Mary and her husband had 5 dogs. They're not all alive at the same time, but they all loved the beach, and she had a picture of 2 of them on the beach and pictures of 3 of her other dogs, and asked if I could put them all together on one beach photo.
Hold on.
And so I think I showed it last week, but now I did some more detail work. So this one is just about done. I got to move it all the way back because this is a giant. This is the biggest one I've done. This is a 20 by 24 inch canvas. So that's those 5 dot 3 Vizslas, a Dalmatian, and I don't know what the other one is. I just a cute brown dog. So I did that. And I'm actually going to be doing a show. it's not really an art show. It's like an arts and crafts fair. So if you are in South Florida this coming Saturday, November 20th, at Coconut Creek, there's a big park in Coconut Creek. I think it's called Sable Palm or something. I'll post all the information and I'll share it before Saturday from 2 to 6 p.m. It's the Coconut Creek Harvest Fair, and they've got all kinds of stuff going on, events for the kids, and they've got like an art and crafts fair and stuff like that. So I have a booth there, and we'll be showing my artwork. So I'll have, you know, I'll be selling custom pet portraits and all some that I have painted. I've, you know, this is what I do in my spare time now, because I'm not really leaving the house much still. So Ron is asking, are all your paintings of animals or do you also do humans? Good question. I do not do humans well. But somebody asked me to paint a picture for she picked in a family thing, her cousin, who recently posted a picture to for a Secret Santa kind of thing in their family, posted a picture to Facebook of the cousin's daughter and dog, and it's a really cute picture. And at least the little girl's not looking, you know, straight on into the camera. She's with the dog and they're reading a book to the dog, and it's very cute. So I said I'd try to do it. I'm not very good at people. So I'll show you it tomorrow and you can judge. I I'll try anything. I didn't think I could paint an animal. I didn't think I could paint anything a year ago. And so I started trying to do it. I'll try, but I wouldn't count on me for a really good picture of a human. Not that. But pet portraits, and I do landscape, you know, not landscapes, seascapes and things like that. Anyway, as we get closer, I'll give you the details. If you're in South Florida, come out and say hi. All right. And with that, we need an escape. I say this every day. We need an escape from the madness that is enveloping this nation. I don't know what the answer is. I hope they get the Build Back Better bill passed this week. I just don't have a whole lot of faith. So I'm keeping at it. Let the sun shine through. Said, keep at it, Nicole, the painting as well as the radio. These days, I get more joy out of the painting, frankly. I'm just being honest with you. I hate talking about the shit that's going on in our world right now. Things should be a whole lot better than this. And they're not. So, I mean, we need to try to make it better, but we need to, I don't know. We need to figure out the madness. I don't know how we do. I'll save that for tomorrow because we're out of time. Thank you for listening, everyone. I'll leave you with the news. I don't know what we're doing tomorrow. Laffy is not here, but we'll figure it out before then. Maybe I'll just open the phones. We'll see. Anyway, thank you for listening, everybody. It is my greatest pleasure that you're here with me each day. All right. I'll see you tomorrow. And thank you. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It's a new week, and Congress is back in session until they leave again for Thanksgiving next week. President Biden waited until Congress returned to sign the trillion-dollar bipartisan infrastructure bill at the White House in what's being billed as a bipartisan signing event Monday afternoon. We'll see how many Republicans actually show up. But still hanging in the balance, the larger Human Infrastructure Build Back Better Act. Democratic Party leadership said they plan to hold a vote on that Build Back Better Act this week. We'll see. In addition to all the infrastructure stuff, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Senate will also take up the National Defense Authorization Act this week. The debate will focus on Afghanistan, China, vaccine mandates, women in the draft, overall Pentagon spending, and other key defense issues. One of the high-profile amendment votes will be the repeal of the 2002 Iraq authorization for use of military force, which Schumer is backing. He also wants to attach the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act to the NDAA. The USICA has already been passed by the Senate. It's a major bill to increase U.S. technology and high-tech manufacturing competitiveness with China. This is a big priority for Schumer. He's trying to break a logjam with the House, which has its own very different version of the legislation. But by adding it to the NDAA, Schumer is hoping to force some action. And then there's the, well, elephant in the room, I guess, government funding. Schumer acknowledged that there isn't going to be any deal on government funding by the December 3rd deadline, so Congress will again need to pass a short-term continuing resolution to avoid a shutdown. But wait, there's more. That's that pesky debt limit. The bottom line is government funding runs out in 18 days. Congress is out next week. They're scheduled to return Monday, November 29th. Funding runs out that Friday. I'll just leave that right there. Moving on, a federal grand jury on Friday indicted former Trump strategist Steve Bannon for contempt of Congress after he refused to comply with a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating what happened on January 6th. Bannon is the first person actually charged in connection with the panel's investigation of the January 6th insurrection. The rioters, who were trying to prevent lawmakers from certifying Trump's election loss to President Biden, echoed Trump's lies that the election was stolen through fraud. Well, committee chair Benny Thompson and vice chair Liz Cheney said they're also considering contempt proceedings against former White House chief of staff Mark Meadows, who on Thursday also failed to comply with his subpoena. Stay tuned. So negotiators from nearly 200 nations reached a deal on Saturday at the United Nations COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow to strengthen targets for reducing carbon emissions and phasing out fossil fuels. But, of course, India forced a last-minute compromise, watering down language on cutting coal use. The agreement, though, calls on wealthy nations to follow through on a promise to help poorer nations adapt and pay for costly damage from global warming. The final deal fell short of the summit's goal of securing concrete commitments to keep global temperatures from rising more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Aminath Shana, who's the Environment and Climate Change Minister of the Maldives, said, The difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees is a death sentence for us. Organizers of the summit said this agreement, quote, keeps 1.5 alive. And as the weather is getting cooler, coronavirus cases have started rising again in parts of the U.S. This after a decline from the summer surge that was driven by the Delta variant. These new trends have been most alarming in the upper Midwest, Southwest, and parts of the Northeast. Nationally, the seven-day average of new cases has edged up to about 80,000. It had stalled at just over 70,000 infections per day for a few weeks, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Public health officials are concerned to see progress against the pandemic stalling as Americans prepare to gather for Thanksgiving. Be careful, everybody. Meanwhile, the globe is just tiring of this pandemic. Austria is now imposing a lockdown, beginning today, on anyone age 12 or older who is not fully vaccinated against COVID-19. About 65% of Austrians are fully vaccinated, giving it one of the lowest rates in the EU. Under the lockdown, unvaccinated people will only be allowed to leave home for limited essential activities. Police will make spot checks on anyone moving freely in public. Unvaccinated people are already prohibited from going to entertainment venues, restaurants, hairdressers, and other places open to the public. This move comes as Central Europe is experiencing a wave of new infections. The Netherlands on Friday announced a three-week partial lockdown there. Three high-profile and racially charged cases continue in the courts this week. In Charlottesville, Virginia, on Friday, they wrapped up the third week of proceedings in what is turning out to be a very long-running civil lawsuit against a dozen individuals and groups accused of planning that deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. In Georgia, the murder trial for the three men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery continues. And in Wisconsin, as the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse nears its end, the governor, Tony Evers, has called up 500 National Guard troops for active duty to aid police officers, if necessary, to, quote, ensure public safety. Rittenhouse is on trial for the shooting deaths of two men and the wounding of another during protests against the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Closing arguments begin Monday. And finally, it's the end of an era. Yeah, I said that. The former guy's family real estate company has reached a deal to sell the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. for $375 million. CGI Merchant Group of Miami is buying the hotel and plans to have it branded and managed by the Hilton's Waldorf Astoria Group. The sale could be finalized in early 2022, but the House Committee on Oversight and Reform plans to continue investigating, quote, conflicts of interest and potential constitutional violations raised by Donald Trump's lease of this hotel from the federal government while he was president. They added that the matter will not be fully resolved by selling off this hotel. All righty then. And one more bit of late breaking news just as we're going to press.
I'm running for governor, and I want to tell you why.
Beto's in.
This past February, when the electricity grid failed and millions of our fellow Texans were without power, which meant that the lights wouldn't turn on, the heat wouldn't run, and pretty soon their pipes froze and the water stopped flowing, they were abandoned by those who were elected to serve and look out for them.
Beto O'Rourke, running for governor of Texas. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these What's News reports, I hope you'll check out my show. The Nicole Sandler Show airs live on the Progressive Voices Network, weekday afternoons from 5 to 6 Eastern, and is always available on video, as a podcast, however you want it, at NicoleSandler.com.